This brings us to the Linda Louise Bergner case versus state. And I'll ask the court, the clerk of the court, to call the case.
May it please the court, Ms. Dawn Moore will argue for appellant. Mr. Charles Orbison will argue for the state.
Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Usually I spend a lot of time at oral argument trying to convince you that there's error in the record, and I'm going to take a little different approach today and be a little more optimistic and assume that you're going to find error and go to addressing harm analysis. Part of the reason I want to do that is because I don't think that I did as good a job as I needed to in explaining what harm occurred here from looking at the entire record. I think I make some sort of global statement to that effect, but don't go through all the things that you would look at in an entire record. And that's clear. We look at the entire record to determine if there's a fair assurance that the error, if any, influenced the jury's verdict or had but a slight effect. Necessarily, some of that analysis includes looking at things that would overlap with the sufficiency review, because the case law says that you look at the testimony, the physical evidence, the state's theories, the defense theory, the closing arguments, voir dire, all of those things, and also the jury instructions. All of those things can impact whether or not there's harm. And I want to start with looking at the testimony, because I think what you look at there is the credibility and the discrepancies in the testimony. And in particular, we have a lot of problems with some of the police officer testimony in this case. And I think that's important because the state makes it pretty clear in their closing argument, and I'll get to that, but they make it pretty clear that their theory is the breath test result being over 0.08, 0.085, confirms the officer's evaluation and administration of the tests and confirms his testimony that she had the loss of normal and physical faculties, or loss of use of normal mental and physical faculties. So we look at that and say, well, he starts off with a bang. He testifies that the driving facts can be visible, or actually at first he testifies that he didn't turn his overheads on when he stopped and the car initially and observed the driving facts that caused him to stop the car, the erratic driving. Then when confronted with the video, the officer says, oh, yeah, I did turn on my overhead, but you just don't happen to see any of the erratic driving I testified to on the tape. He makes other mistakes in the report, such as saying that there was a moderate odor of alcohol in the report, but then testifying to a strong odor of alcohol. His administration of the HGN is also suspect. He does it multiple times. He testifies that he had problems because Ms. Bergner was blinking, but then he also clarifies that some of the problems could have been because of the way that he was holding the flashlight. He has another officer who shows up at the scene also perform the HGN, and actually the way it works on the tapes, he starts to tell Ms. Bergner that she's under arrest. You can tell. He says, all right, well, at this time, and then he goes, hold on a second. And he goes to the other officer at the scene, Hudson, and says, can you just tell me how many clues you get? And then that officer performs.
Excuse me, how many what?
How many clues? I'm sorry,
I'm
Your Honor.
Sorry,
how many,
I thought you said how many who's you get. All right, go ahead.
It's about the same, probably. But he says, how many clues did you get? And the officer performs the field sobriety test. Sergeant Perry says that he does not testify to having any of the problems with Ms. Bergner blinking that Sergeant Perry had. And then they turn off their mics and go off camera and discuss it before he comes back and arrests. So I think I bring all this up not so much as a sufficiency review, but as the credibility of the testimony and discrepancies in the officer's testimony about the loss of normal and physical and mental faculties. And that's important because we can look at that. We can see, would the jury have had some question about this based on what the testimony was presented. The other thing is that the officer, intoxilizer operator, Johnson, says when he testifies, I was in the room with her. I didn't do HGN. All I did was check to see if she had nystagmus because of a head injury. She had said she'd been in an accident, actually, is what he says. And then when they show the tape to him, it's obvious on the tape that he is performing the HGN test. You can see him doing the swipes back and forth, and it takes approximately 59 seconds. And so it's obvious that he does more than just check for the injury. So again, looking at another witness who had some discrepancy in their testimony. He also did not file a report and could not remember anything, even after reviewing the tape, about what his observations of Ms. Bergner were in the intoxilizer room. And then the state points out that Crystal, Ms. Bergner's daughter, testifies, and that, well, certainly the jury just discounted her as an interested party. But what she testifies to is confirmation that Ms. Bergner had been in an accident 8 days prior to the DWI arrest, and that in that accident she has sustained injuries to her leg as well as cracked or bruised ribs. So I think that that could have gone to the jury being able to look at whether her problems performing on the field sobriety test might have been related to those injuries, especially in light of what we see from the physical evidence. And that's another aspect we're able to consider. The physical evidence from the tape, from what the jury can observe, shows that Ms. Bergner talks normally, she steps out of the car fine, she walks around fine, there's no sway. The only time she has any problems is during the field sobriety tests. And again, she has some of these other medical, these injuries that could help account for that as well. Not to mention the fact that you have to look at how the officer told her to do the tests, and whether his administration was done in a way that her performance would necessarily follow clearly. But looking at her in the intoxilizer room is even more of an issue, because in the intoxilizer room, she sounds better than the officer ever dreamed of on his best day, as far as he sounds in reading the statutory warnings and in talking to her. She sounds clear. She sounds coherent. You don't see any sway. There's nothing like that. And certainly the jury can consider that evidence, and we should consider that as part of the record in reviewing whether there's any harm here. Another thing the state says is that, well, she looks better in the intoxilizer room because she's sobered up at this point, because she was arrested for DWI. Well, and this is in the brief, not at trial. And one of the things that was testified to at trial by the intoxilizer supervisor was that the range that she believed, based on retrograde extrapolation, could be anywhere from 0.07 to 0.10, or from 0.10 to 0.11, depending on the time of the last drink. So even using the state's expert witness, that testimony could have said that she was less intoxicated at the scene than she was in the intoxilizer room. So the notion that, well, suddenly she just looks good in the intoxilizer room actually flies in the face of what the testimony was that they presented. And then certainly we have to look at Fondon, the intoxilizer supervisor, because the jury can't help but be influenced by an expert. That is the only expert they had. So when we're looking at whether or not it harmed Ms. Bergner to have the jury hear this evidence, certainly when you have an expert witness testifying and that expert is confirming the mediocre or discrepancy-laden testimony of the officers, that would go to showing some harm. Additionally, we look at the closing arguments, and the state says that, well, it's not, admits that some of it is emphasized, but maybe not dramatically. I will say that there are five separate instances where they point out the breath test, and certainly all of that has to be read in context, and even my pointing those out now doesn't really help you as much as reading it yourself. But the state does argue on pages 271 to 272 all about the breath test and the retrograde extrapolation, and says particularly if that's a 0.07, she's a 0.07 at the scene, I don't want to see a 0.08. They also say at another page 273, they mention again, you can find her guilty, she's at a 0.08. At page 288, the second prosecutor says a 0.85 confirms everything that Sergeant Perry said. And then he says it's not just about the breath test, but he does specifically say and confirm what I think the state's theory was, which is, all right, maybe these officers didn't do a great job and maybe she doesn't look that drunk on the tape, but you've got a breath test to confirm what they say, and that adds to their credibility. The other thing I would like to address today is a mistake that I made in the argument regarding inherently coercive. There's always one. There's always more than one. But in particular, I noticed that I did not point out that there's a different standard for Texas and the United States once the defense has rebutted the presumption of consent. And I believe that we rebutted it, and that under either standard, the state did not rebut the defense's rebuttal. But I did not put those standards in there. And I spoke with the state prior to this, and we would both welcome the opportunity to do additional briefing on that should the court determine that it's important in its decision. In this particular instance, I don't think it makes a difference. In Texas, it's clear and convincing evidence. Under the United States, it's preponderance of the evidence. I think under either method, the state did not rebut the defendant's evidence that she was coerced. So I think under either method of analysis, they didn't do it. But if it were to be important to this court, thought that there was a little bit more one way or the other, certainly we would be glad to address that. I argue that I believe that the statements made here were inherently coercive, and I do believe that. I do think that there are certain statements that have to rise to the level of inherently coercive, absent a rebuttal, which we don't have. I think this is spot-on Erdman. It's just absolutely the same statements. She's in the intoxilizer room. You can watch on the tape. She calls her friend. Her friend is saying, you agreed to blow, don't blow. I mean, you can't hear the friend's conversation, but you can hear from Ms. Bergner's conversation what information she's being given. And at that time, when the officer comes back in, she stands there for a few minutes while he's doing paperwork, and then she says, "What happens if I refuse to blow?" And the officer says, "You go to jail." Now, I know the state's going to argue she already was in jail. People don't understand that. They're in a holding cell. She testifies. I didn't really completely get it. I still thought I might go home. Certainly when they arrest them, they always say you're under arrest or detention for investigation of DWI, leading you to believe that there may, and he says that on the tape, leading any person to believe that there may still be a possibility that you're not going to be spending the night in jail. And also, the requirements that we read, the statutory warnings, are only read to people who are under arrest and in jail. So if that's the criteria, nobody could ever do anything to dispute this. You could say whatever you want after you've arrested someone in order to get them to blow, and it would be okay. So certainly the fact that she, whether she believes she's in jail or not, whether she believes that is not relevant. Also, they say, well, there's no causal connection with what the officer says because her friend tells her. Well, that just doesn't make sense either. If I get stopped in my car and the officer says, "I want to search your car," and I say, "Well, hold on, let me call my dad," and I call my dad and ask him, and he's like, "If you don't let them search, they're probably going to call the drug dogs, and you could get arrested anyway. You might as well just let them." So then I get off the phone and ask the officer, "What happens if I don't give you consent?" And the officer says, "Well, you go to jail, or I'm going to call the drug dog anyway." How can we say that that's a voluntary consent just because some person who is not the expert, who is not the authority, who is not the government or the power, possibly said that this might be the consequence? If anything, it appears on the tape that she is confirming whether or not that is accurate before she decides. And up until the moment she puts her mouth on that mouthpiece to blow, she can say no. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Moore. Mr. Orbison.
May it please the court. She testified that she knew she was going to go to jail if she blew, and she knew it before she asked the question. That, to me, closes the door, end of story. She testified, and the court is certainly welcome, to see that in the record. It's cited in the state's brief, that she knew that if she refused, she would go to jail. She knew that before she asked the question. I would also like to invite the court not to jump right ahead to harm, although as counsel was discussing harm in this case, it really reminded me of the jury argument at trial. It sounded a lot like it, and is almost as if counsel was addressing another jury, but this court is not the 13th juror in this case. The jury heard all the evidence that counsel brought up, every bit of it, watched the tape. Admittedly, she doesn't sway. Admittedly, she sounds good, but you know what? The officer testified at the scene. She didn't sway, and her speech was not slurred. So that doesn't really in any way detract from the officer's credibility, because he testified that that was the case at the scene. What you can observe on the videotape does not really affect the officer's credibility. But at any rate, the jury got to watch the videotape. The jury got to hear all the evidence that counsel referred this court to, and the jury decided that Ms. Bergner was driving while intoxicated on the date in of the case.
But when you say we're not to act as a 13th juror, that sounds like you're arguing illegal sufficiency.
Right, and I'm not. And as counsel said, she's not either, even though her brief says that, and she corrected that, and we all understand that the harm is not a sufficiency. But even though I use language that you sometimes find in sufficiency arguments, as counsel said, some of the things we do in the sufficiency argument, we also have to look at in a harm analysis. And that's why I use that language. But I didn't mean to imply that I'm doing a sufficiency argument. One thing I do want to inform the court, because I noticed that the court on its own motion has called for Defendant's Exhibit 1. There's no dispute on this. Appellant says in her brief, and the state says in its brief, that States 1 and Defendants 1 are the same tape. They're exactly the same. And, of course, the court has both of them now. It granted the state's motion to transfer States 1 to the court, and then on its own motion, it's transferred Defendants 1. I just thought I might be able to save you some time. They're the same, exactly the same tape. So counsel began by saying, I'm just going to assume that you're going to find that the trial court abused its discretion here. Really? We had a situation where she was arrested, and there's a great amount of evidence presented in the state's harm analysis that driving facts and so forth, that why she was arrested at the scene. She was taken to the intoxilizer room, and there's no dispute. Videotape clearly shows it. She was properly read the warnings contained in the statute. She was provided a written copy. She was asked if she would consent to provide a specimen of breath, and she says yes. Now, the officer, for some reason, did not take her cell phone from her, and so when he leaves the intoxilizer room, she simply dials up and has a conversation with the friend. It is very clear, I think the court will agree when it watches the videotape, if it hasn't already, that the friend says, don't blow. Do not provide a specimen of your breath. And it's very clear that Ms. Bergner knew she would be going to jail if she refused to do that. Her end of the conversation makes that very clear. Nonetheless, she testified that she had decided not to give a specimen after this conversation. Yet the officer comes back in the intoxilizer room, and you'll see him put a stopwatch to it if you want to, more than 2 minutes. He's sitting there filling out papers and doing things. She's standing there. At no point does she say, oh, officer, I've decided not to provide a specimen of my breath. Sorry, I want to withdraw the consent that I previously gave. At no point does she say that. So what the jury heard and saw on the tape, the jury heard that she gave consent, and it was never withdrawn. She does ask the question, what happens if I refuse? And he says, well, you go to jail. Now, did that all of a sudden coerce her into providing that consent when she already knew she was going to go to jail before she asked the question? The tape makes that objectively, abundantly clear. There's no question about that. She even testified that she knew that. So the other thing she was left with at the suppression hearing on redirect is, how else can I say that when the officer told me something I already knew, how else can I say that that coerced me into providing the consent that I had already provided, not withdrawn? Well, now it was an inference from what the officer said. The inference was that since he told me something I already knew, now suddenly I have an inference that of something else, that I'll be allowed to go home if I pass the test. That seems to me, in all respect to the appellant and counsel, that's a stretch to argue that I was coerced based on an inference that I drew for the first time after being told something I already knew. I don't believe the court abused its discretion. The court heard her testimony, the cross-examination, the redirect, and concluded that her consent was voluntary. It was not coerced by the officer's statement in response to her question, because she had said minutes before that she already knew she would be going to jail if she refused to provide the sample. This is an Erdman case in the sense that we need to look to Erdman for the analysis. This is not an Erdman case, as so many, in my opinion, so many defense attorneys think Erdman is automatic. If the officer says anything other than the statute, we've got a reversal on our hands. We're great. That's not exactly the case when you read Erdman, because Erdman makes it clear that if there is evidence showing that the extra statutory warrant information the officer provided did not, in fact, lead to coercion, enforced consent, then Erdman goes the other way. And that's what we have here. Here, she knew what the officer's answer was before he gave it. There is no way that what the officer said could have coerced her. There was evidence, and it is very clear on the videotape, there is evidence that what the officer said did not coerce her consent. As we look at the harm, I'll just real briefly, because it's contained in the state's brief, and I don't need to regurgitate it all for you today unless you have questions. But we have the driving facts. We have, after the stop, the strong odor of alcohol. We have bloodshot, droopy, glossy eyes. We have, perhaps most as important as anything, lying to the officer. Ms. Bergner said, no, I wasn't drinking at all. And then the officer goes, well, there's been wine spilled in your truck. And she goes, yeah, I was drinking, and yeah, I put a glass of wine in my truck, and yes, it spilled. Sorry, I was lying to you all this time. We have all those facts. She failed two of the three sobriety tests. She technically passed the walk and turn, but she put down, her foot down four times, if I'm not mistaken, and that's only counted as one clue. So technically, she passes the walk and turn. The jury was clearly informed about both definitions of intoxication. They knew that you could be intoxicated by impairment, loss of physical and mental faculties, as well as the per se definition. I guess the counsel and I would just have to disagree with how the breath tests were emphasized by the state in closing argument. The first attorney did make some reference to a per se definition. But it's also clear, and I cite in my brief, that even the first prosecutor that argued in closing said there was some doubt here, because the extrapolation range was from 0.7, 0.07 to 0.1 if the drink occurred, if there was a drink at the time of the stop or right before the time of the stop. And since there was wine in the car, that might be a reasonable deduction from the evidence. I don't know. It's for this court to decide. But so the extrapolation was 0.07 to 0.1. And the first prosecutor did admit that there's doubt there because of that 0.07. Now, the second rebuttal prosecutor never mentions the extrapolation at all. The second prosecutor, I think the court will agree with me as it reads the closing arguments, that the second prosecutor is really arguing the impairment theory. And he is using the breath test as an evidence of impairment. And the Court of Criminal Appeals has said that's fine to do. So you almost have to treat this as a non-extrapolation case, since the extrapolation, under the extrapolation, it could have been not per se intoxication. The lower end of the extrapolation was 0.07. The daughter testified about the accident. She also testified that truck, oh my goodness, that truck will not even go straight. But yet we know, because the defense attorney got out of the trooper, that after he turned on his videotape, that truck didn't waver. Drove straight. So in other words, this is the magic truck that can only drive straight when there's a video camera pointed at it, but can't drive straight at all mechanically otherwise. That testimony just was not believable in the state's opinion. I won't really continue through the harm analysis. There is more there in the states, and I think the bottom line is that there was not harm, even if this court could somehow find that the trial court abused its discretion. Counsel did not argue today about the 3823 instruction, which I believe is point of error 4. Since counsel did not argue it, I won't bring it up unless there are any questions about that. Otherwise, I will just conclude by saying, yes, I agree with counsel that if this court believes that the burden did shift to the state to prove that the consent was voluntary, that there are two standards, and under the United States Constitution, it would be preponderance, and under the Texas, it would be clear and convincing. I also agree with counsel, it really doesn't matter here, because take the worst standard, I mean the stiffest standard, not worst, but clear and convincing, it's pretty clear to me that she knew the answer to the question before she asked it. Therefore, the state did, in fact, prove that her consent was voluntary and not coerced. Are there any questions by the court?
No questions are indicated.
That state would pray that Ms. Bergner's conviction be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Orbison. Ms. Moore, you've got 5 minutes.
I hate to fall into this trap and waste all my time, but real quickly I have to answer to something. When the state said that Crystal testified the truck had problems and was all over the road, there's actually support for that in the record, too. When Ms. Bergner stopped, she immediately talked to the officer about the fact that the truck has steering problems. On the tape, when she's talking to her friend, and there's no indication that she knew she was being videotaped. On the tape, when she's talking to the friend, she says, "Yes, I was in so-and-so's truck, that stupid truck." You know, so it's not like it sounds like this was just concocted when we got to trial. There was evidence at the scene and in the intoxilizer room that would support that. In addition to that, on the tape, you don't see erratic driving. So, you know, maybe there was some driving before it, but the officer's statement that the truck was all over the road is not apparent from the videotape. I completely think that it is automatic that if it's inherently, let me back up. State said that a lot of times defense attorneys think, oh, if we say these statements, it's automatically a problem. I think it is if we show that it is inherently coercive, because then they have to rebut that it's not. And that's the deal here. She testified that she was coerced by that. She testified that that is the reason she gave the breath test. And there was a videotape that supported that. I don't know what else a defendant is ever supposed to do. You know, whenever we run into these situations, the defendant gets on the stand and says, the officer said this and that made my subjective intent be X. That's usually all you can do. Here, we have other proof that would support what she said, that she did believe that was her subjective intent. So beyond just the cross-examination and her testimony, we have some visual evidence that that's what was going on. And you can see it from watching that visual evidence. And you can see it from the question that she poses. So I don't see how it can't possibly shift to the state to prove either by clear and convincing evidence or by preponderance of the evidence that there was not a connection, that there was no causal connection between what the officer said and that she wasn't actually coerced. And they didn't do it. And just saying you knew you were in jail doesn't meet the burden of rebutting that. Okay, they didn't actually say or get her to admit, yes, I wasn't really coerced by the officer. I was coerced. I knew because what my friend said, and so I wasn't going to blow regardless, or I was going to blow regardless. They didn't get her to say that. So just her statement that, yes, my friend said this, would not be sufficient. Plus, I take issue with the way that testimony came out, as it is so often. When the defense attorney's asking one thing, it comes out one way. And when the state's cross-examining, it kind of comes out a little different. And I think you have to look to the cross-examination and the direct examination of Ms. Bergner to see what the true intent was and what she was trying to say. Because the statements were, he says you were in jail, and she says, I thought I was in jail, I didn't know. And then eventually he keeps cross-examining her, and she says, yeah, I did think I was going to jail. But immediately afterwards, when her attorney redirects her, she says, I thought that I would get to go home. I thought that I might get to go home. I did not know until he told me, and that is the reason that I blew. And I'm paraphrasing that, but it's all in there very specifically that you can see that part of that is just from the way that we necessarily question people, but it was not a clear, unequivocal, the officer didn't have anything to do with my decision. My decision was made because of my friend's statement. That's not what happened here, and that's not what she said. I would ask this court to determine that the evidence was not properly admitted, and also just very quickly to say that, yes, there was this testimony. Yes, everybody emphasized about normal physical and mental faculties, but in addition to that, the jury heard the .085 breath test results and the retrograde extrapolation. So we can't say, well, the jury just rejected that she wasn't intoxicated or that she was intoxicated by loss of normal use. We don't know what the jury did because the indictment provided for .08 as well as loss of normal use. And so we don't know if the jury concentrated on the .085 or if the jury concentrated on her being intoxicated by loss of normal use. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Moore. Mr. Orbison, we appreciate your submission of the case. You are excused, and you will hear from the court shortly. Thank you. Ask the clerk to adjourn the court.
All right.